This event was recorded live as a part of Cleveland Council on World Affairs Foreign Policy Forum, Election 2016. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer of the Brookings Institute joined us to discuss dealing with Putin's Russia. Please visit ccwa.org to learn more about our upcoming speaker series programs.
First of all, Heather, thank you very much for that introduction. Mike, thank you for the opportunity to come out here and speak to you all, and thank you all for coming out. And who chose the map? I'm also glad that you show Crimea correctly, illegally annexed by Russia, but still properly shown as part of Ukraine on that map, so good choice. I've been asked to come out and talk about dealing with Putin's Russia. And when you look at Russia today, I think now and for the foreseeable future, Russia poses both a foreign policy and a security policy challenge. And my guess is that's going to remain the case for the foreseeable future. So what I'm going to do in my talk is break it down into three pieces. First of all, talk a little bit about where Putin and Moscow are coming from. What's driving them? What's driving Russian policy today? Second, I'll talk a bit about what are some of the implications for key American interests. And then third, I'll offer some comments on what I think the American policy response should be. So let me begin with where's Russia coming from? But let me go back about 25 years. And in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, there was a certain assumption in Washington and in most Western European capitals about Russia. And that assumption was that we might not agree with everything on Russia, but in general, Russia wanted to be cooperative, it wanted to be a partner with the West, it wanted to draw closer and work with and integrate with Western institutions, and it accepted the rules that prevailed in Europe and was prepared to play by them. And so what you saw on the part of the West was an effort to be inclusive with Russia. So in the mid-1990s, the G7, the group of seven industrial democracies, it expanded to bring in Russia, even though arguably in 1997, Russia really wasn't an established democracy. When I was working on the National Security Council staff in the mid-1990s, and we were preparing the way to move forward on enlarging NATO, President Clinton was very adamant that there needed to be a parallel track with Russia, that we should try to shape a relationship between NATO and Russia, and the goal was to make that relationship so cooperative that the Russians would see NATO as a security partner, and they wouldn't then see a threat posed by NATO enlargement. Now, in the end, I think, in retrospect, we overestimated our ability to build that relationship, and we probably underestimated the antipathy in Moscow to the idea of NATO continuing. But there was still that idea, can we be inclusive? And then also at the end of the 1990s, we began the negotiations with Russia to bring Russia into the World Trade Organization. So those were the assumptions back in the 1990s. I think they continued in the early 2000s. But if you look at the last several years, I think people are coming to the conclusion, including the US government, that those assumptions no longer hold. You know, that Mr. Putin, that the Kremlin, they do not want to be a partner with the West. They don't want to draw closer to the West. That they see themselves outside the West, and they've been pretty candid about this. There's been an American pivot to Asia. Putin talks about turning to Asia. He says, we can't play with Europe in our rules. We can look at Asia. And in terms of foreign policy, he really has tried to set Russia up as, in a way, the antithesis of the United States. So that's a very different Russia from what we'd hoped to be dealing with back in the 1990s and early 2000s, but that's what we have to do, we have to deal with. And I think you saw this very clearly back in 2011, and this was, Mr. Putin had been president from 2000 to 2008. Under the Russian constitution, you can be president for two consecutive terms, so he stepped down and became prime minister while Dmitry Medvedev ran as the president. In 2011, he said he was going to then run for the presidency again in 2012, and it became pretty clear that one of the key elements of his campaign was a very strong nationalist tone and a very strong anti-American tone. And I think that was probably an indicator that we may not have picked up on as quickly as we should have that things were going to change. So let me talk a little bit about what are the four or five reasons why we're seeing this change. Why has the Russia that we hoped we were going to have 15, 20 years ago, why do we have the Russia now? And I'll go through about four reasons. You know, first of all, it's Russian domestic politics. Russian foreign policy derives first and foremost from the Kremlin's concern about domestic politics, and job one for the Kremlin is regime survival. So much of that foreign policy now is directed to ensuring domestic support for President Putin and for the Kremlin. And I'll give you an example about how we've seen a change. From 2000 to 2008, when you talk to Russians, they would say that Mr. Putin has this informal social compact with the Russian people, in which he says, in essence, you're not going to have a political voice, you're not going to have much political say, but what you will have is economic security, you're going to see a growing economy, and you're going to see your living standards rise. And that was going to be the basis in the early 2000s for Putin's regime legitimacy. And Vladimir Putin was very lucky at the time, because just after he became president in 2000, the price of oil began to climb. And I cannot tell you how dependent the Russian economy is on oil and the price of oil. One of my colleagues at Brookings, Cliff Gotti, he's a very good Russian economist. He basically takes a chart of the price of oil, and if you overlay a chart that shows the growth or the fall in the Russian gross domestic product, they're almost identical. Well, Putin became president when that price began to skyrocket. And so he was able to deliver big time on the economy. From 2000 to 2008, the Russian economy was growing at an average rate of 7% a year. And so people saw their economies grow. You had a rising middle class. People could buy cars. They could travel. Things really began to change in very positive ways, particularly after the 90s, when the Russian economy had been in free fall, and really there were a significant percentage of the population was impoverished. When Mr. Putin came back to the presidency in 2011, I think he calculated correctly that economic story isn't going to hold. Because after the economic crisis of 2008-2009, the Russian economy was growing at maybe 1.5% to 1.7% a year. And you had Russian economists saying, is that enough for Mr. Putin to uphold his side of the bargain in terms of delivering economic prosperity? And I think what you saw in 2011-2012 was Mr. Putin changed the narrative. Regime legitimacy was no longer based on good economic performance, but it became based on nationalism, Great Russia, Russia's return as a world power. And he's had some success with that in terms of it plays well with a good segment of the Russian population. And we're seeing, I think, part of that now reflected in Russian foreign policy, both in Ukraine and also in Syria. A second thing is, Mr. Putin and the Kremlin believe that the post-Cold War security order in Europe has evolved in a way that disadvantages Russian interests, and that the rules no longer are rules that treat Russia equally. Every year in Russia, I've not been to these, but I follow these on the press reports, there's a Valdai discussion club, and they get 50 experts from the West come, and the highlight is you get to meet with Vladimir Putin and talk to him for a couple of hours. Well, in 2014, the Valdai Discussion Club behind it said, new rules or no rules. And that may describe the Russian attitude, because they look at what's happened in Europe and they say, this has not worked to our advantage. And the key case in point for Putin is the enlargement of NATO, the enlargement of the European Union. Now, Mr. Putin has a narrative about NATO, and it basically says, back in the early 1990s, when Russia collapsed, the United States, Britain, and Germany decided to take advantage, enlarge NATO, hem in Russia, bring military forces up to Russia's border, and basically try to keep Russia weak. I think that narrative is completely wrong. I can go back and cite things that NATO has done in the last 20 years that were designed to make enlargement as painless as possible. So, for example, in 1997, saying that in the enlargement process, NATO would take on the policy of there would be no permanent stationing of substantial combat forces on the territory of new NATO members. And NATO basically observed that until 2014, when Russia went to war against Ukraine. But the problem I have is, as much as I think his narrative's wrong, he's talked himself into it. He believes it. So as we shape policy, we have to understand that Mr. Putin, in some ways, thinks he's fighting a defensive conflict against an enlarging NATO. A third thing I think that we have to take account of is Mr. Putin's very concerned about what he calls color revolutions. When he looks at the 2004 Orange Revolution in Ukraine, or the 2003 Rose Revolution in Moldova, or the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine 2 years ago, or the Arab Spring, he doesn't see those in terms of populations that are unhappy about, in the case of the Orange Revolution, a stolen election or authoritarian governments. He talks about those consistently as organized by the CIA and MI6 and German intelligence. Again, I think he's completely wrong on that. But that's his perception of the world, that these things are not indigenous events, that these are orchestrated from outside. And his concern is ultimately the target is Russia and a color revolution in Russia. And again, I think it's wrong, but that shapes how he's looking at the outside world. A fourth point gets back to how he dealt with President Bush, where early on after George Bush took office, in Mr. Putin's view, Russia did some things. After 9/11, very importantly, Russia canceled a military exercise to make sure that there was no interference with US plans for Afghanistan. Putin basically said, I won't object if you want to deploy American forces down here into Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan to sort of support operations against Afghanistan. He closed down an intelligence facility in Cuba, closed down the naval base in Cameron Bay, and in his view, the Bush administration did not reciprocate. What he got was more NATO enlargement. He got expansion of missile defenses, questions like that. And so that relationship between the Bush administration went downhill. And for reasons I don't fully understand, he didn't seem to recognize that when Barack Obama came in, Obama tried to change that relationship and put it on a different footing. And then I think one last factor that has led to the change in Russian policy is that, again, with that rise in oil prices, a lot more money coming into Russia, coming into the Russian budget, all of a sudden you begin to have more money for the defense and the military. And he has the wherewithal to do things now that 10 years ago the Russian military couldn't do. So those are some of the drivers that explain where Russia's come to. And let me talk for a moment about some implications for American interests. And I think what we need to look at, Russia is a challenge today in a way that it wasn't 5 years ago. So we have to think about Russia a little bit differently. And it reflects both the will on the part of Vladimir Putin. It reflects the fact that, again, with more money, he has the ability, he has capabilities now that he didn't have 5 or 6 years ago. And I think it also reflects, in his view, a very low estimation of resolve in the West. You know, when he looks at the European Union, he sees the Europeans divided and really focused inward on questions like migration, is Greece going to leave the Eurozone, will the British leave, those sorts of things. I think President Obama made a major mistake back in September of 2013 when he drew a line in the sand on Syrian use of chemical weapons and then did not follow through. I think that had a big impact on how Russia looks at the White House. And in a way, I worry that sometimes now they may underestimate the president's resolve when it comes to things like protecting NATO territory. But I think three areas I'll talk about in terms of challenges. The first one is Ukraine. And what you saw in the aftermath of the Maidan Revolution in February of 2014 was Russia moving to take Crimea. The appearance of what the Ukrainians called little green men. These were people who were clearly professional soldiers by the way they handled their weapons. They wore Russian combat fatigues, but no identifying insignia. And in March of 2014, a reporter asked Mr. Putin, he said, who are these little green men? Are they Russian soldiers? He said, no, they're just local defense guys. And the reporter said, but Mr. President, they're wearing Russian combat uniforms. And Putin says, well, you can get those in any army surplus store anywhere in the post-Soviet space. Now, the reporter didn't think to ask the next follow-up question, which should have been, well, do they get those tanks and armored personnel carriers in that same sort? 5 weeks later, at a press conference, Putin said, no, those guys, they were Russian soldiers. So you had the seizure of Crimea, in part because the Ukrainian military chose to stay in garrison. There were about 10,000 Ukrainian troops in Crimea. They stayed in garrison. They chose not to fight. And I think that reflected a decision in Kyiv that if shots were going to be fired, they should be fired first by the Russians. In April, within less than a month after Russia had, in my view, illegally annexed Crimea, you saw Russian support for separatism in the Donbas area, right in here, Donetsk and Luhansk. And by support, I mean it was the provision of leadership, So in May of 2014, the Prime Minister and the Defense Minister of the so-called Donetsk People's Republics were both Russian citizens, both had apartments in Moscow. Leadership, money, heavy weapons, including the Buk surface-to-air missile, which in July of 2014 shot down the Malaysian airliner. And at a couple times, in May of 2014 and then early last year, I believe you had intervention by regular units of the Russian army in eastern Ukraine. So this has been a huge issue between the United States and Russia for a couple of reasons. One is a general concern here, rightfully so, that the Russians have shown a willingness to use force. And that basically is a violation of the cardinal rule of the European Security Order, or what we thought was the European Security Order. It goes back to the 1975 Helsinki Final Act, and that is you don't use military force to change borders or take territory. It's a particular issue for the United States, and a particular issue for me personally, because I helped negotiate it, was in 1994 in the Budapest Memorandum of Security Assurances, the United States, Russia, and Britain basically pledged to respect the sovereignty, the territorial integrity, the independence of Ukraine, pledged not to use force or threaten to use force against Ukraine. And this was a big deal. This was a big part of achieving a shared American-Russian objective, which was getting 2,000 strategic nuclear warheads out of Ukraine. And the Russians have violated all of those commitments, and I think that imposes an obligation on the United States to respond. But it also raises the question, Russia having used now force in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine, might the Russians be tempted to use force somewhere else? And I'll come back to that in a moment. A second challenge I think that we've begun to now face in the last several years is in fact Russian military modernization is proceeding at a fairly rapid tempo. Now I look at it and I would say there are some things that we have to worry about, some things are not so worrisome. So just break them down in pieces. The Russians have a very active effort now to modernize their strategic nuclear forces. They're building 400 strategic ballistic missiles this decade, 8 new ballistic missile submarines. And I look at that and I say, well, that doesn't bother me so much because, first of all, most of that is replacing old stuff that had they had more money in the 1990s or the 2000s, they would have replaced 10 or 15 years ago. So I don't worry about that as long as two things apply. One is that the limits of the new strategic arms reductions treaty hold, and two, that we do some things to modernize our strategic forces, although I don't think we have to do as much as the Pentagon might like. But I don't think that that's a big issue. A second area is conventional forces. And here we've seen a dramatic improvement. Russia won its conflict with Georgia in 2008, but the Russian army performed very badly. You know, they've shown that they've actually learned some lessons, better equipment, better training, they're more effective now. And again, they're trying to, their goal is to have 70% of their equipment modern by 2020. But again, I look at that and I say, no, there's still some things that make me perhaps not so concerned. One is the technology gap. The Russian military is still learning high tech. So everybody was impressed in October of last year when the Russian Navy fired sea-launched cruise missiles out of the Caspian Sea here into Syria. And that's a fairly modern capability, but again, that's a capability the US military has had for almost 30 years. So they're catching up. Another factor that makes me a little bit less concerned about the Russian military, its conventional forces, is they're still dependent on draftees. 300,000 Russians were conscripted in the military in a total force of about 800,000. And in Russia, conscription is only for 1 year. And I'm not sure that in 1 year's time you can give a soldier the kind of expertise and training that they need to compete with Western militaries where you're talking about professional soldiers. The area that I think I'm probably most worried about with Russia's military modernization is what they're doing with non-strategic or tactical nuclear weapons. And it's coupled with modernization of those weapons and doctrines and loose talk in Moscow about nuclear weapons. So they have what they call this escalate to de-escalate doctrine, where we may escalate to nuclear weapons to end the conflict on terms favorable to us. And that combined with the fact that Mr. Putin seems to talk in a rather loose way about nuclear weapons has me just a little bit worried that does he see nuclear weapons as they should be seen, which is as weapons of deterrence, or does he look at them and say maybe these are weapons of coercion? And I think NATO needs to be thinking a little bit about that. I'm not sure it requires any hardware changes by NATO, but does NATO doctrine need to adapt to deal with that? And then the third challenge we face now is Syria. And I think that's going to be a difficult problem between Washington and Moscow. Russian motivations there, I think, are very clear. First of all, they want to support Assad. He's one of their few international allies. They don't want to see him go down in a revolution. And last summer, his position looked quite weak. In general, again, they don't like to see these popular revolutions bringing down governments. And the third reason I'm actually somewhat sympathetic with, and I've had Russians raise this with me, they say, okay, if Assad goes, what comes in behind him? And I don't think we in the West have a good answer. And the Russian concern is you're going to have chaos, or you're going to have ISIS, or something like that. And I don't think the West yet can explain that in a satisfactory way. But I do think that Syria will be a challenge on the US-Russia agenda for a couple of reasons. One is, we differ so widely on what happens to Assad. In the Western view, and this is not just the United States, it's Europe, it's Saudi Arabia, it's the Gulf countries, Assad can't be part of a long-term solution. I mean, most of the Syrians who've been killed in this conflict have been killed by the Syrian army, and Assad bears a responsibility for the fact that so many Syrians have left. Russia doesn't see it that way. But also the point is we're fighting two very different conflicts in Syria. American and coalition airstrikes target solely ISIS. Russian airstrikes occasionally hit ISIS, but they're more heavily focused on hitting those opposition groups that are the urgent threat to Assad. And in some cases, those are opposition groups who have representatives now in Geneva to engage in political talks. And so I think those differences are going to keep Syria as a challenge on the agenda. So I think when I look at these sorts of problems, you know, it's hard for me to say, you know, we're going to be in for an easy time. Now, I do try to be optimistic, so let me inject my note of optimism for the evening. And that is, in the past 30 years, there have been remarkable turnarounds in relations between Washington and Moscow. 1984, when I was working for Ambassador Paul Nitza, the Soviets had broken off the talks on intermediate-range nuclear missiles, on strategic arms. There was nothing going on. In 1985, January, Secretary Shultz met with Foreign Minister Gromyko. They started some negotiations going. Within 3 years, you had a treaty banning all intermediate-range missiles, major progress on the Strategic Arms Treaty, some cooperation on regional questions, and human rights progress in just 3 years. The second example would be in 2008, after the Russian-Georgian conflict, again, very difficult relations, a low point in US-Russia relations. And again, when the reset came in with President Obama, within a year and a half, you had the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty. You had very significant Russian cooperation on helping us put pressure on Iran to end their nuclear weapons program, and Russian cooperation in Afghanistan. So things can turn around. Although I have to say, in this case, I'm not quite so optimistic. I think to get that kind of change, you're going to have Moscow adjust its policy, probably first and foremost on Ukraine. So with that, let me talk a little bit about the future in US policy and what, how to deal with President Putin. And let me also start here by saying, I say President Putin a lot, and it's a mistake on my part. We shouldn't totally personalize the policy. If Vladimir Putin makes a mistake tomorrow, steps off the wrong curb and gets hit by a bus, the person who comes in behind him is going to probably look a lot more like Putin than like Gorbachev. Because that is that elite structure in the Kremlin, that inner circle around Putin, primarily comes from the security services, people with his background. You know, Sergei Ivanov, who's been defense minister, who's now the head of the presidential administration, also came out of the KGB. Nikolai Patrushev, who heads the Russian Security Council, KGB background. And again, that, it's a closed group, which is a bit worrisome. But it's not just, I say Putin, but we're talking about that group that's running the Kremlin. But US policy, I think we need to anticipate we're going to have differences with them for some time to come. And I would argue there are maybe three elements of the policy. One is, we have to look at ways to constrain Russia and sometimes push back. Two, we have to look at ways to deter Russia. And then three, though, there still is a role for engagement. And I'll talk about each one of those in turn. And let me start about the pushback piece. And this, I'll take the example of Ukraine. Pushback and constraint, and what I think we need to do, and this is really working with the European Union. When you look at the countries hope it doesn't go down badly with Moldova, I call these countries the in-betweens. Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, countries that are bordered by NATO and the European Union on one side and on Russia on the other. But in terms of constraining Russia, we've got to look to, are there things that we can do for those countries to help make them more resilient? Make them, help them stabilize, make progress in terms of an economy. that will be good for those countries, but will also reduce the opportunities for the Russians to come in and make mischief or try to destabilize them. So in the case of Ukraine, I would argue continued political support. I think the West, and this is the US and European Union, should be doing more in terms of offering additional economic assistance, provided that Ukraine do more in terms of reform. And I would also argue that the West should be providing military assistance or greater military assistance to Ukraine. Not with the idea that we're going to give the Ukrainian army the ability to beat the Russian army. They're not going to be able to do that. But what we want to do is give the Ukrainian army the ability to raise the cost to the Russians of renewed conflict in eastern Ukraine. That may help change the calculation in Moscow about whether or not renewed conflict makes sense. Another part of constrain is working with the Europeans to keep in place some degree of political isolation. If you go back about 16 months ago when there was the G20 summit in Australia, there's this wonderful picture of kind of a set of tables in one of the hotels where all the leaders are, and there's Vladimir Putin by himself. He left that summit a half day early because basically people wouldn't talk to him. He says he doesn't mind that. He minds it a lot. But also the economic sanctions, I think they're very important. And the economic sanctions, they're having an economic impact. In 2015, the Russian economy contracted by about 4%. Now, that wasn't just due to sanctions. That was also due to the fact that the price of oil, which went up, has now come down. And that's causing pain. And last fall, when the Russian government approved its budget for 2016, the budget assumes a price of oil of $50 per barrel. Last month, about 2 weeks ago, it went down as low as $28. And they've already, looking at that, most Russian ministries have been told to cut their expenditures this year by 10%. So it's having an economic impact, the oil price, but also the sanctions. Now, they haven't yet achieved the political impact, which is to get the Russian government to make a significant change in its policy towards Ukraine. But the impact, the effect of sanctions is cumulative, and I think there still is a chance that they might, in fact, achieve that. But the goal here of constraint is to bolster countries like Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia so they're not susceptible to pressure from Russia. And then that, and then use things like sanctions to change the calculus in the Kremlin with the goal of getting the Kremlin to change its policy. On the military challenge, how should the US respond there? And I think, first of all, we need to modernize our strategic nuclear forces. We're on a different cycle from the Russians. They're doing a lot now. Our modernization cycle really hits in the 2020s. Now, I think what the Pentagon wants to do is probably more than we need to do. We don't have to go that far, but the idea there is to make sure that we do have a robust strategic deterrent. I would argue that what we do need to do in military terms, though, is pay more attention to NATO. Since 9/11, NATO's main function, actually, if you go back and look at from 2001 up until about 3 years ago, not Markey was down in Afghanistan. There were probably 35,000 NATO troops fighting alongside American troops in Afghanistan for most of that period. NATO now has to sort of relearn what it knew during the Cold War is not counterinsurgency, not counterterror operations, but how do you get back to territorial defense? And that'll mean some doctrinal changes for the alliance. It'll mean some more investments in conventional forces. And I worry in particular about the Baltic states up here. Now, I do not think that it's a high probability scenario. I do not think it's a high probability that the Russians might attack Estonia or Latvia, or that little green men might show up in Narva in eastern Estonia. But I don't think it's a zero probability, and 4 years ago I would have said that probably would be zero. So NATO, I think, has to think about this, think about the worst to be prepared for it. And that does mean, I think, deploying some additional conventional force capabilities into the Baltic region and Poland. Some of you may have seen today's Secretary of Defense Carter made an announcement, and I think he's doing some good actions. He's requesting money, for example, to deploy an additional armored brigade's worth of American equipment into Europe, and then plans to have an additional brigade's worth of people cycling in there. And again, a lot of this is basically designed to reassure NATO allies, but it's also designed to make sure that that red line between Russia and NATO territory is very clear, very bright, and very red. And basically trying to make sure that the Russians understand that NATO will defend NATO territory so that the Russians do not make a horrible miscalculation. On Syria, I think we try to work with the Russians in Geneva to see if we can get a peace process going. I think we keep the door open if the Russians would alter their military strategy to more cooperation, but I think we need to be realistic. I don't see Syria as coming up as an element of cooperation. It's going to be more of an area where we try to contain a problem. Now, so that's kind of the deterrence piece, the constraint piece. Let me now talk about the engagement piece, and that even though we have, at this point in time, I would say, the worst relations with Russia since 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, there are still going to be areas where our interests converge, where talking to them makes sense. One would be implementation of the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty, which on Friday celebrates its fifth year of implementation, and by all appearances, it's going well. The sides are reducing, they're exchanging data every 6 months. They've done over 10,000 treaty-required notifications in 5 years. Each side has done its 18 inspections for this treaty year. So it's working well, and I actually think that the treaty has more value in Washington and Moscow now than when it was signed. Because at a time of tension, I think both sides appreciate that you have an overall cap on strategic forces, plus the notifications and the inspections and the data exchanges give us a lot of insight into Russian forces, so we don't have to make worst case assessments, and vice versa. So that's one area. I think Iran is going to be an area where we can cooperate, because the Russians don't see the prospect of an Iranian nuclear weapon in the same nightmare terms that we do. And that reflects the fact that they've had a diplomatic relationship with Iran for 40 years that we haven't had. But Moscow doesn't want Iran with a nuclear weapon. There's no way that that is good for Russian national security interests. So we're going to want to work with them and at the International Atomic Energy Agency, at the UN, to make sure that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, in fact, is implemented. So that's an area. I think a third area is going to be Afghanistan. If Afghanistan fails, if chaos returns there, the Taliban come back, that's a huge problem for us. But just look at the map. It's a problem that's 6,000 miles closer to Russia. And it's a threat to this Central Asia, which they regard as their backyard. So again, we may be mad at each other, but there's going to be a hard interest on both sides in cooperating not to see Afghanistan fail. So I think I look at this, in addition to engaging on those areas where interests converge, we also want to hold out the prospect to Moscow that, look, you know, if we can begin to resolve some of these questions, specifically Ukraine, we can get back to a more normal relationship, which we would like to do. Having said that, I think we also have to be realistic and expect that we may not see that necessary change in Russian policy, and that for the foreseeable future, we're going to have to be persistent, we're going to have to be patient, and we're going to have to have resolve. And I guess the last comment I would make is when I look at these pieces, deter, constrain, and engage, I think my final point to you would be the better we do on the deterrence piece and the better we do on the constrain piece, the more likely it is that we'll change that calculation in Moscow, and the more likely we'll find it that the engagement part, talking to Russia, becomes more successful and more fruitful. So at that point, let me stop my prepared remarks and be happy to take questions.